Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Carrboro Board of Aldermen work session for Tuesday, June 8th, 2010. I understand that the drum circle outside is breaking up shortly. But anyway, this is a work session, so we do not normally take public comment. It's time for a more extended discussion amongst the board members about some subjects in more depth. The first item on our agenda tonight is a discussion of the five-year update to the Orange County Hazard Mitigation Plan. Mr. Manager, do you have a presentation?
Trish, are you doing the introduction or is...
Okay.
The presentation this evening is following up on a conversation that you all had back in May. And just in brief, the town has participated since 2004 in a formal hazard mitigation plan, a multi-jurisdictional hazard mitigation plan with Orange County and Hillsborough. And we have been, I guess, implementing that plan since that time through our various efforts with emergency services and so forth. The purpose of hazard mitigation planning is for there to be a local, logical means of planning for responding to natural hazards, such as hurricanes, floods, earthquakes, etc. The plan maintenance provisions in the rules require a process of updating the plan take place every 5 years. We began the update process back in 2008, and have gone through the review process with folks at the state as well as FEMA. And there are representatives from the town staff who participate with staff from Orange County, Hillsborough, Hillsborough on this effort. The questions that were noted on May 18th. Are presented here, and we did provide responses in the agenda packet as well. The maps that were not included in the plan as it was presented at that time have been available for about the past 2 weeks on the web in conjunction with the plan itself. The question about chemical hazards, there's some explanation there, and also, we've responded to the question dealing with chemical hazards, and a question about the why the plan doesn't really address threats associated with Sharon Harris. Same is the case with regard to earthquakes and volcanoes. I've got some information about the metric that was used for assessing risk in determining local risk in terms of these natural hazards in Orange County. And then the last question dealt with safeguards. What safeguards exist regarding the threat of nuclear hazards? I do want to point out that that Shannon Berry and Clint Osborne are here from Orange County. Shannon works with the Planning Department and Clint with the Emergency Services Department. And I'm just going to briefly go through the questions, and then they're here to fill in the blanks. I was not the staff person who worked on this effort, so they're going to provide that perspective for you if you would like them to do so. The 17 maps that are included in the plan depict jurisdictional boundaries, natural features, floodplains, floodways, the paths of tornadoes and hurricanes that have struck Orange County since we've been keeping records of those events, population density, and the locations of critical facilities. The information that how the plan does not really fully address chemical and nuclear hazards is provided in your packet. But just in summary, the plan is really designed to address natural hazards. In 2002, the staff and the local governments preparing this plan did decide to include chemical and nuclear hazards in the plan. So there is some information on that. In the plan, and the, due to the location of transportation arteries and the uses that occur in this region, the risk of chemical hazards is a, has a high, there's a higher risk of a disaster associated with that. So the decision was to include that, and there is a little bit more emphasis on that, on chemical hazards in the plan. There is also some information, as you may have noted, regarding Sharon Harris, but as our actions with regard to any events that might occur at Sharon Harris really deal with recovery, response and recovery, this plan is really looking at mitigating hazards by setting in place processes that would reduce risk before those hazards were to hit the county.
Are we a party to the emergency operations framework the way we are to the hazardous mitigation plan?
I believe so.
I can speak to that now or later.
Okay, when you come up, you can ask.
It's a, yeah. The information that the plan is based on is the best available information, and with regard to the question about volcanoes in particular, while there are geologic formations in this area that reflect past volcanic activity, and there are no active volcanoes in the vicinity of Orange County or elsewhere in the state of North Carolina. So in reviewing the risks associated with these, with this particular hazard, there was a determination by the staff that there was no risk associated with volcanoes and a small risk associated with earthquakes. But the seismic activity, since it's been recorded, is very low in our region. The metric that was used to assess risk led to basically a determination that risk was evenly distributed throughout the county. There are floodplains and floodways throughout the county. There are transportation arteries pretty much throughout most of the county that deal with this chemical hazard risk. But the potential for hurricanes and tornadoes apply equally throughout the county, and so there was not seen as a differential risk of these natural hazards in different parts of the county. Assessed building value was used as a measure of potential damage or impact associated with any hazard events, and the plan does recognize that where there's greater population density, there is the greater potential for damage or injury and so forth, but it wasn't used to weight the evaluation of risk. I might just stop at the safeguards related to nuclear hazards. This is really outside of my realm of information, and this is information that Clint provided, but we do have some safeguards in place in town dealing with response to nuclear hazards, and as you've noted, and we'll probably hear a little bit more about the county is working on an emergency operations framework, and we'll be seeking to take steps to make sure that we have processes in place and information for citizens on what to do if something like that were to occur. Happy to try and answer any questions. Our recommendation tonight is that you do adopt the resolution that's provided adopting this plan. Both Hillsborough and the county have taken that action, and it would put the town in a good position with regard to hazard mitigation funding and other actions should there be a disaster related to a natural hazard.
Trish, there's a mention of an appendix that would deal with nuclear fallout. The question I have is, and then previous to that, it mentions that there, what we're talking about here is mitigating, not so much reaction, response, or actions after an event. And yet it also mentions that there could be mitigation programs, North Carolina Emergency Management, if we were to implement this appendix within this mitigation plan. So I'm just wondering.
The appendix they're talking about wouldn't be part of this plan. It would be part of the emergency.
That's right.
I can elaborate on that.
Okay.
Perhaps that time has come.
Perfectly fine, thank you. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Trish.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Trish.
Thank you, Trish.
I don't know if you need to do anything.
I'm not going to answer any questions as I can.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi. My name is Glenn Osborne. I'm the Emergency Management Specialist for Orange County Emergency Services, and I will endeavor to answer the questions as I think in the order that they were posed, but I may have to go back to you to have you ask that question of me again. So we'll begin with Mr. Coleman. What was the question specifically?
It was about whether we're a party to the emergency
operations
plan and the way we are to this.
Right. So the process for emergency response planning is a little different from hazard mitigation planning. Hazard mitigation planning is very structured, as I think you've seen here. This is in and of itself been a 14-month, I think, process to get to where we are. The town of Carrboro traditionally has maintained its own emergency operations plan, and I believe Captain Mills in the fire department is the primary person responsible for that to Chief Crabtree. That's the last we talked about it. What we have done in the past is we make every effort to dovetail our plans so that jurisdictionally, Carrboro can take response measures that we would like to see fold into a larger county response so that we don't do things like duplicate resources or take measures that someone else is taking or share public information in an uncoordinated fashion. So the county is responsible to report to the state, and the organizational model that we use is sort of a wheel and spoke. So all three municipalities, the university, the hospital, and the non-governmental organizations report to the county EOC, and the county EOC reports to the state. In our planning, we try to take the same format. That said, I think the question, to maybe speak to Mr. Slade's question of the appendix, we recognize that in order for us to have a smartly and well-coordinated response, we do have to have, even if it's the county's plan and the town has its own emergency operations plan, we recognize that in our hazard-specific appendices that we're preparing to develop, that it's going to require a larger stakeholder discussion than maybe the general framework of the county's emergency operations plan, whereas that has been written in the past, and we're really working to update it. As we roll out these new appendices, such as the specific appendix for an event at Sharon Harris, we recognize that there's going to be a greater need to open that portion of the discussion up to all of our partners throughout the county. Specifically, the hazard mitigation plan does not require that you address a specific hazard within your plan to be eligible for mitigation funding down the road. So where in the emergency response framework, we recognize the need to have a coordinated response to an incident at Sharon Harris, and so we're doing that because we think it's in everyone's best interest. With the hazard mitigation plan specifically, it does not require that we have a nuclear appendix to be eligible for mitigation funding after an event or even before an event, and I can explain a little bit more about hazard mitigation funding, how it works. It's a fairly complicated process, actually.
Could you also explain the difference between mitigation before an event and mitigation after?
Absolutely, absolutely. So mitigation, I think Trish said it really well, is the goal of mitigation is to lessen the impact, ideally before an event. So one example of probably the most tried and true method of mitigation that we see in this part of the state is zoning people out of development in floodplains. So what you've done is you've taken the floodplains and you've eliminated building within the floodplains. In doing that, when you have a flood, you no longer have the impact on life and property that you have if you allow building within the floodplain. Does that make sense? So you've essentially mitigated that. The way that mitigation works from a practical perspective and the way that it works from a funding perspective are not exactly aligned, okay? So where in a perfect world we would mitigate as much of our risk out of the pool as we could before we ever had a disaster, we all recognize that, one, that's probably not realistic just because there are hazards that are going to impact us in ways that we haven't previously seen, and we'll change our operations going forward. Zoning, planning, a lot of mitigation is planning and zoning. After the way funding is handled is 5% of any federally declared disaster funding for a state for any disaster has to go to mitigation. Okay, so let me give you an example. If we had a hurricane tomorrow and it caused $100 worth of damage and it was a federally declared disaster, $5 of that would have to go to mitigation funding. But what you're seeing is what's going to happen is you're going to take that $5, which is from that's been identified and allocated from the disaster, and then we take that money and we try to eliminate threats before the next disaster. And so that's how the process works. And what being party to a hazard mitigation plan, being part of an adopted hazard mitigation plan allows you to do is when disaster mitigation funding comes along, you're eligible. Okay? And so there are, to say that the only time you can get disaster mitigation funding is after a disaster is only partially true, because every once in a while, and I stress every once in a while, we'll see, it's called the legislative pre-disaster mitigation. And what it is a congressperson identifies money for mitigation in a region. We have seen that in the past locally. It's sort of unexpected when it happens. And so what we do from a planning perspective for mitigation projects is we try to keep an eye on what projects exist in our community that we could put money towards if the money becomes available. The other thing that's important to note, and as we go into hurricane season, keep this in mind, whereas recovery funding and response funding reimbursement is related to whether or not a hazard has hit your area. So, for example, that same hurricane I was telling you about causes $100 worth of damage, but it's all at the coast. And those are the counties that are declared emergencies, and the federal declared emergency is there. Mitigation funding can go anywhere in the state. So if the state of North Carolina declares an emergency for an event, the $5 is going to get spread all across the state for the mitigation projects. So it's a neat way that they don't, whereas with response and recovery, they're really trying to make communities more whole again. With mitigation, it's all focused on the greater good over the longer haul. Did I address your questions?
Yeah, just for follow-up, on the nuclear appendix.
Yes, sir.
The memo indicates there's no timetable yet for even beginning work on that. Is that right, or?
So, kind of right.
Okay.
So my goal is to have it in an approved form by June or July of 2011. And while that may seem like a long time to wait on something like this, what my goal is that it will properly fit into the rest of the emergency operations framework. And I would expect that would have a lot of stakeholder buy-in, a lot of community education, a lot of information gathering.
That sounds like a reasonable time frame. I think you're starting from scratch.
Yeah, and you never start from scratch. We will be talking to our friends in Chatham County, Wake County, Durham County, all of the counties that are like ours to try to see if we can sort of get ahead of the learning curve by using existing plans.
So what I'm understanding is that there's 5% of money only after there's been a disaster goes towards mitigation. Or when there's the specially allocated federal money.
Yeah, and there's
just a follow-up question on the does that mean that if it's that 5% will be allocated towards identified hazard reductions that are in the hazard reduction plan, and if so,
no.
Okay.
No, that's what I said. That's why it's important to make clear, because I know you guys have identified the issue of radiological issues. If in the process, for example, of writing the appendix for responding to nuclear events, we identified mitigation activities that we could take for a nuclear event, we could certainly apply for the funding to take those mitigation steps towards mitigating a nuclear event. Does that make sense? So it does, just because we don't have a robust discussion of nuclear issues or of nuclear hazards in our plan does not eliminate us from seeking mitigation funding for a nuclear-related event in the future.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is the hazard mitigation plan includes things that aren't necessarily man-made, because
right.
It's not required for the funding to be set up for that. But does that mean that we shouldn't have prepared for mitigating, irrespective of whether that was needed for this?
Right. Certainly not. If we identify something going forward that we think we need to take specific, we need to take specific measures and planning steps for, then we'll take those. And I think we talked a little bit about how a lot of it has to do with the amount of control we can have over an incident. So to talk, somebody asked, well, we have earthquakes but not volcanoes. Well, we can look at the hazard profile for earthquakes and we could say it's relatively common and volcanoes not. But if going forward we identify that maybe there is a threat to volcanoes, we can certainly write that in the future.
So it's dependent on how much control you have over it. And with man-made disasters, there's plenty of control in that there we are man.
Sure, absolutely.
And so with Sharon Harris, in as much as they may be proposing new reactors, then hopefully a plan would include mitigating measures or descriptions for how to prevent that from happening to begin with. So that's kind of what I would hope a hazard mitigation plan could include. Even though for FEMA funding, it may not call for man-made disasters, that we could have a plan that could include man-made mitigation.
Absolutely.
So,
and there is some indication that going forward, FEMA is currently revisiting the hazard mitigation process. They're actually beta testing a new process and a new sort of like template. Going forward, my contacts at the State Office of Emergency Management tell me that there's a high likelihood in the future that man-made events are going to become a required portion of it.
So the appendix just is for the emergency operation framework, which isn't for mitigating.
And that's where I'm trying to go. So the purpose of creating an emergency operations framework, and stop me if I bore you, but the purpose is to unify all of these plans. And so historically, we've had the hazard mitigation plan, we've had the emergency operations plan, we've never had a recovery plan, which is something identified last year that I want to fix. And what I'm trying to do is bring them all in together. So the hazard mitigation plan actually becomes, over time, part of the emergency operations framework. And just the same way that you've identified that, you know, we know that there are things that we probably don't do as good a job with as we'd like, and we'll get there. But what we're trying to do is unify these things so that when we identify something in either the hazard assessment during the hazard mitigation planning, we can go back and say, well, is this really something where mitigation is a solution, or do we really need a really robust response capability? And I think that's the appendices are really about response right now. And then ultimately, the hazard mitigation plan will either become an appendix to the emergency operations framework, or it'll become a child plan to the emergency operations framework. Our goal is to coordinate rather than to write plans in a vacuum. And you guys see enough zoning and planning to know how that's supposed to work.
So in closing, I just want to understand, for nuclear, there is no projected plan for mitigating.
No, not right now.
Okay.
Now that said, as we develop the response appendix, we might identify things, actions, steps that we can take to mitigate some of the impacts to life and property going forward. But right now, we don't.
Mm-hmm. I find that highly troubling, considering, for example, what's happening in the Gulf Coast, where there could have been a lot of mitigating measures. And though nuclear doesn't happen so often, and I know one of the measures for identifying a hazard is how likely it is, but there's also the degree to which something happens, and nuclear is catastrophic when it does happen, as rare as it may be. And so for that reason, I would hope we could have something a little more robust, as a minimum be able to point out the amount of money it takes to create such a plan, to point out how this is another instance where the public takes on the cost, the true cost for production of energy, such as nuclear or oil or whatever it may be.
I just to piggyback on Sammy's point, thank you, Clint. I think you did a great job of explaining some things that are really intricate.
It's not a simple topic.
No, really complex, especially when you combine looking at the plan and then looking at the funding. But Sharon Harris has had several fires, and it's not rare, and it's something that we're also not that far away. And I know that the plans for Chatham County and for Sharon Harris, look at a 25-mile radius, and we're just within 35. We're so close, but we're not included. Who would pay? Is that something that's designated you know, if something, if there was a fire, if there was some kind of, you know, emissions leakage, who pays when Sharon Harris, you know,
has a problem?
Has a problem.
Mm-hmm. That, so the nuclear, it's they call it the responsible party. Just like BP is the responsible party in the Gulf Coast right now. And BP is going to...
Irresponsible. By
yeah,
being held responsible.
There you go.
Hopefully.
By definition, the responsible party. In that they're responsible for the cost of cleanup. Now, for example, if we had an event that let's just say, blanketed out 35, 40 miles with a dust that then contaminated your water supply and your food supply, there's really two options at that point. You either literally haul off the top 6 feet of soil and replace it with new soil, or you move everybody out. Mm-hmm. That cost, my understanding from talking to my folks at NCEM, is borne by the responsible party, and then if we bankrupt them, then the federal government has to support that.
Except that the nuclear industry, under federal law, their liability is capped.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. So they are the responsible party in terms of the payment for response. So if we do have an event that causes us to respond and we have to take money and resources out of the coffers of Carver and Chapel Hill and the county, that's like any incident, we keep track of that. We need to keep track of that cost because that can be charged back to them as a responsible party. And then I think the next question you would ask is, well, what about the next step? And the next step is, how do we get things back to normal? And that's really, in emergency management parlance, that's where we've gone from response. Sorry, guys. That's where we go from response to the recovery phase. And the recovery phase, again, they're responsible for the cost. Now, it is capped, and the federal government, like I think we're going to see in BP, is going to have to come in and probably share some of that cost, although BP is got a lot more.
So do I understand you...
Not enough.
Do I understand you to say that at present time, Orange County doesn't have a nuclear hazard mitigation plan in place?
No, we only have the one hazard mitigation plan. So if it's not in the current hazard mitigation plan that you have before you for approval, then we don't address it from the perspective of hazard mitigation. Mm-hmm. That isn't to say that we're not going to address it from a response perspective, or we're not going to address it as part of our recovery plan either. Mm-hmm. So there's, I hate to like throw terms at you because I know that you guys don't do this every day and I do, and so sometimes I forget that.
So we're good with terms.
All right, okay.
Well, if we're not, we'll ask.
Well, emergency management, the way we visualize it and the way it's been handed to us by FEMA is that it's a four-phase process, and it's preparedness and planning, mitigation, response, and recovery. And so each phase has its own set of, for lack of a better term, rules. Mitigation, in this case, is handled through the mitigation process. And a lot of what we talk about and what we think about, I think, with response to an incident there or anywhere. I mean, you know, if a tanker of ethyl methyl bad stuff turns over on mm-hmm. Main Street, right outside of Weaver Street, mm-hmm. you know, we're gonna take response and we're gonna move into recovery. That doesn't mean that there aren't steps we can take down the road now that we've identified a hazard and try to mitigate those away. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the questions I think you're asking really we need to address as part of our coordinated response and recovery as well. Mm-hmm.
Do you, when this plan is approved, do you make a communication to NCEM and/or FEMA as part of that approval?
Shannon, NCEM's already reviewed the plan, and FEMA gives us conditional approval. And with that, once FEMA gives us conditional approval, what we do is we go before all of the boards who are participating in the plan for adoption. Mm-hmm. And once they adopt, we send the final approved plans and the copies of the adoption materials to FEMA, and that's my understanding, and I think our understanding is that as soon as you adopt, Carborough has adopted the plan, mm-hmm. and the issue of getting the materials to FEMA is then just basically closing the book on it.
Okay, so my question is part of those materials, is it possible for you to include our concern that the catastrophic risk of nuclear accident is something that only the state or federal government could mitigate by, first of all, not allowing any expansion at Sharon Harris and ultimately seeking to end the use of nuclear power, and that our board, which I think we would vote on this if we could have this communication, you know, urges them to look into that mitigation, to pursue it. Is that something you could communicate to them on our behalf?
So if I said yes, I'd really just be taking a swag at it. So what I would suggest, what I would suggest is that you all and your officials work to adopt it in such a way that also presents your concerns. So
that we would put that in our resolution tonight. We could include the language I just stated.
Yeah, okay. I think that's where to go.
Yeah.
Okay. Nice. Are you making
a motion?
And I'll second that motion.
Yeah, I just made
excellent.
It.
Excellent.
Okay.
Sarah, do you feel like you have that language?
Include that in the resolution.
Yes. All right. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously. We are very appreciative of your coming and spending some time with us and listening to our board's concerns.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. So what? Just one last question. I'm sorry. I always miss the horse when I need to. I'm not saying you're – I mean, the item.
Better just get a helmet question.
Yes. to have there be a mitigation item that's nuclear-related, is that solely something that is done from the federal level, or can we take that process here locally, whether it be the county or municipal level?
Mitigation actions can be taken at any level. Ideally, you know, as we say, emergencies start and end locally. So it's going to start here and it's going to end here. And mitigation is one of those fine examples of where understanding your community and your risks, the more intuitively you understand those, the better you can identify mitigation measures. Really, the federal government likes to pay us to do projects. Does that make sense?
Right.
They like for us to, and I will tell you, and I will quit, is that the mitigation project, well, I know you guys have a full agenda. The mitigation process is very intensive. It involves a very intricate cost-benefit analysis.
Right.
And if the community has already identified and started the legwork on those cost-benefit analyses, then the application process is much easier. You have a much better shot at getting it.
So I would hope we would find a way to initiate that cost-benefit analysis, if possible. Is that something?
Well, that sounds like something you can take leadership on.
Okay.
Well, and I guess I would be interested, not necessarily just at this moment, to hear about what mitigation measures along those lines would even be, because just off the top of my head, I don't particularly know. But so I don't know if anybody has some information along those lines to share that might give us an idea of what kinds of, you know, strategies or ideas we would even be evaluating, or, you know, just as examples. Give it a little context.
I'll be happy. It's actually fairly structured. It's fairly structured. The Hazard Mitigation Grant Program is a fairly structured program and has some fairly strict limits on what is allowable, what's an allowable cost. And I will be happy to forward the information to your planning department through Trish, who's been working with us thus far, and show you all the guidance and let her, if you guys would, that's at your discretion to have a report back. But I think the first step is.
Right, maybe if you could share that with Trish and Trish with the board, then we could just begin to get the kind of the flavor of what it entails. What kind of issues it even involves. And then pick up on the discussion from there, depending on what looks like. Does that seem reasonable?
Yeah. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks again.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And thank you again, Trish.
That puts us on item D2, a discussion of engineering site plan review process. Mr. Manager.
Okay. Marty Roop has a brief presentation to hit some of the high points of the information in your agenda packet, and Henry Wells with Sungate Engineering is here as well if you all have questions of Henry. So, Marty.
Yes, primarily just have some comments. I do have the checklist available to put up here if you want to see them. But since you do have them in your packets, I basically just want to introduce the item and offer some comments. The item before you, as Steve mentioned, discusses the stormwater engineering review process and possible changes to it moving forward. And draft versions of a residential and a commercial checklist are included. Staff looks forward to any feedback you may have tonight and or any further direction or clarification you may wish to provide. I just want to speak a little bit about the checklist itself to reiterate some of what's in the agenda item, the package you received. They really just serve as a tool to implement possible changes to when we receive information in the development review process. We have not to date contemplated any actual changes to what those requirements would be, the type of information or the amount of information. It really just shifts from the pre-permit stage to the post-permit construction plan process, shift the timing of when we receive some of that information. The residential list actually just formalizes some of what we've done over the past few years on a case-by-case basis. We've worked with the developers when we get relatively close to the public hearing stage. We usually sit down and have a meeting and talk through a few of the remaining issues and, where appropriate, find a way to add a condition to the permit that takes that and puts it in the construction plan stage. So the residential list basically formalizes the ones that we've seen come up over and over. A good example would be the engineered drawings behind a retaining wall. We still know more or less what that wall would look like, but the actual engineered drawings we kick to the construction plan stage. Or the receipt of the Clomer permit. There's some FEMA permits where we've been requiring that the study be done up front, but the actual receipt of the permit from FEMA could be kicked to a later stage. The commercial list actually delays, though, at the applicant's discretion, some of the submittal of the information to that construction plan stage that we have not done in the past. Henry can speak more to the details if you're interested in hearing about the details. It does involve some risk on the applicant's part if they choose to do it, in that they would potentially have to do some redesign to the site if they've not done all the upfront work before the public hearing itself. So there is a little risk, and we've set it up such that it would be at the applicant's discretion. I'd just make note that the residential list, as I said a moment ago, basically formalizes what we've been doing, and it, if it has your support, could be implemented immediately. The commercial list, as we noted in the agenda item, actually requires some land use ordinance changes before it could be formalized. So with that, I'll just repeat one last time to make it perfectly clear. We have not contemplated so far actually reducing the amount of information for any project, be it residential or commercial. We're just shifting around the timing. And Henry is here, and either he or I are available for questions.
Yeah, I have a question for Henry.
I thought I had a question. How can you always get to go first?
Sure.
I raised my hand. I followed the rules, so I'm going to go first.
Mark called me a few weeks ago not to raise my hand.
Okay. I understand. Two questions I have. The first one is, the worry I have is if the engineering review process, if it doesn't pass and we've already passed the CUP, will it automatically have to come back to us for approval? And where, for example, if a neighbor who had an issue about the stormwater runoff on their adjacent property, where would they have an opportunity to have input in that discussion as they would now normally?
The ordinance currently contains language that directs us to call any change, either an insignificant deviation, a minor modification, or a major modification. Insignificant deviations we handle at the staff level. So that would have to be something that literally does not affect any particular neighbor.
Right, right.
And just wouldn't really be very noticeable. A lot of times changes of that nature we will call minor modifications, and they do have to come back before you for approval, but it doesn't necessarily require a public hearing unless it's presented to you and you stop and say, I think we need to call a public hearing for this. A major modification is treated as a brand new application and definitely involves a public hearing. So we would have to make a judgment call on that at the staff level if changes were necessary at the construction plan stage. And that's probably, that sufficiently answer your question?
It does, and sort of, I need a follow-up, then I'll ask my second question. I guess my next question with that is, could you give me an example of a minor modification and, because I can't think of one right now, and a major modification where staff has said, we think you need a public hearing? Because I think those boundaries for both the public and the developers, if we're going to make these changes, need to be out front so people can't say, well, mine's not really a major when it really is a major, mm-hmm. and a minor is really a minor modification.
Well, perhaps some other staff folks can help me with this. Off the top of my head, the only one that is coming to mind immediately was probably 4 or 5 years ago when Carrboro Plaza, this actually never came to fruition, but just as by way of example,
right.
Was asking permission to add a building between Food Lion and the credit union
right.
on that little grass
right.
patch.
Okay.
We at first deemed that a major modification because it was a brand new building. You know, it's a big site already, but it was a brand new building that had never been there before. And we kind of entered the review process and realized that calling it a major modification was going to entail a lot of requirements that weren't very plausible for the applicant, you know, redoing all the lights out there and
right.
lots of big changes. We've sent, as a side note, we've since changed the ordinance to allow things like that to go
right.
through a minor process. But back on topic, we took that one, if my memory is correct, we determined that it would be okay to call it minor, but say a public hearing is necessary.
Okay.
But by and large, we leave that to the board's discretion. We don't necessarily come in, or it's rare that we would come in with a recommendation for a public hearing. We just leave that to your discretion.
Okay. My second question is, do you know if it's going to cost on our side more or less money in terms of consuming staff time if, say, we reduce some of the stuff and the information up front, and then on the back end, it increases the cost of our operations? And whether we capture that in terms of fees or what have you. And that's my last question.
Can I jump in?
Oh, sure.
I think in most cases, probably if you look at the project as a whole, it would be revenue neutral compared.
Okay.
But where there might be a difference is on a commercial project, if you all made these changes and the project were denied, we would have spent far less staff time on the front end, and we never would have gotten to the more detailed
okay.
engineering review if it got denied, whereas now there's a significant amount of staff and engineering time to get an application in
mm-hmm.
front of the board before anybody knows whether or not it will actually
okay.
be approved. Does that make
okay.
sense, Marty?
That
That's
does.
Very helpful.
Yes.
Thank you. Those are all the questions I have.
I think Dan was next.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, on that point, Steve, that's really from conversations with developers that I had, I guess, a year or so ago that led to this whole topic coming up, is that, you know, the developers are basically in that same situation of putting a lot of money in, and if there's not an approval, is there a way to put some of it off? And that's why also when I brought this up in September, my concern really was to find out in CUP review, and this gets to Joel's first question, what were sort of the consequential issues that we'd addressed, that the public had raised, or the board had raised, or that had come up in our discussion. And so if we decide to go ahead and take this to public hearing, I would like to get some background at that time that would require a little research in terms of going back over the minutes of some recent, over the past couple of years, some of the CUP public hearings, and seeing what kinds of issues came up in regard to engineering, so we can determine whether they were consequential or not, and whether or not the proposed changes would impact the considerations that are commonly coming up. And that said, I do have a question for Mr. Wells.
Good evening, everybody.
Thanks for your help with this little project. I have, I don't know if Steve had forwarded you the question I emailed him about your letter to Marty, but at the end of the second paragraph, it says, it describes the need for detailed design at the CUP stage in order to avoid subsequent CUP modifications. And then in the middle of the next paragraph, it says, however, prior to construction, the project, you know, presuming these changes, the project will still have to meet the same high stormwater quality, et cetera, standards that Carbro has come to expect. And those two statements struck me as a little bit contradictory, or if they're not, I didn't understand how they fit together, because it seemed like on the one hand you were saying the CUP review was important, and on the other hand it seemed like you were saying we can meet our goals without it. So if you could speak to that.
Yeah, I think it's just a timing matter. It's a matter of when you want the information. Do you want the information before you approve the CUP, or do you want it before the project is put on the ground? And that was what I was trying to get to here, is that no matter if you decide that you want less information at the CUP stage when you make your decision to render the permit, by the time the thing goes on the ground, you're still going to get the same detailed information in the plans that you would have gotten at the CUP level. It's just going to be a little further down the line.
Okay. Right. Okay, thanks. That makes sense. And Marty, following up on that, I think this is a question for you primarily, is your sense of kind of the range of issues that come up under these this engineering review, how much of it actually is discretionary in terms of things that are addressed by board action, the public hearing, as opposed to things that are just a matter of what the ordinance says? I mean, there's lots of things that we already don't review at this level that go to the construction phase.
Right.
And, you know, we do things like create the lighting policy, but, you know, or perhaps, I don't know if that's a good example or not, but then gets implemented, you know, and in another part of the process. So I guess my question is, do you have a sense of how that balances out in terms of the engineering?
Yeah, I'll address that and then ask Henry to either confirm or add or modify to what I say. I think primarily a lot of site planning is driven by, these days at least compared to a decade or two ago, is driven by stormwater engineering, which is to say the lay of the land determines, you have to find a low point where the water will go and then find an exit point for the water. So a lot of this work that we're talking about, at least in the private sector side, will still have to be done before it would ever, at least let me say, if the private sector engineers is doing their job properly, they will have completed a lot of this work before it comes to public hearing. So the reality of what we're talking about is that it wouldn't have to get into a detailed back and forth between the private sector engineer and the town engineer, which is perhaps a strange way of saying I don't think that it would change that much in with respect to what you see at a public hearing stage if the private sector engineer has done their job properly. The devices should more or less be where they are going to end up and should more or less look like what they're going to end up if the engineer has done their job well.
Okay, thanks.
Would you agree with me?
Yeah, I just add to just say going what Marty said. This process that the NPDES regulations and the Jordan Lake rules have put the town into has made the design a more iterative process than it ever was. I mean, the developer comes in and he wants to put his development on the best properties. Well, there's 40% open space to deal with, there's floodplains to deal with, there's other buffers to deal with. So once he puts his piece of the jigsaw puzzle that he wants to develop, then there's not much left to put these devices on. As Marty said, these devices have to go downstream of any development because they have to pick up the water from all of the disturbed land and treat it before it leaves the site. So it's a back and forth between the designer and the developer. Okay, I want to put this here. Well, no, you can't put it there because I've got to be able to treat the water before it leaves the site. So it's a back and forth thing, and it just takes a whole lot more time, a whole lot more cooperation between the developer and the engineer. The engineer can't just go off and or the designer can't just go off and design the plan and say, here it is, anymore, because those things have to be taken into consideration and both parties have to weigh in on it.
So the devil is in the details, you say?
Exactly.
Mark, I have two questions. Since staff had requested the checklist of Sungit, have you found that to be helpful? Has that, since September, that checklist?
Yes, I'm sorry. I meant to mention that earlier, actually. It went out to approximately 20 individuals or agencies. I don't know precisely how many, you know, an agency will have four or five engineers, and I don't know exactly how many of them reviewed it, but the responses have been quite positive. You know, basically along the range of it looks fine to I think this will be very helpful and will in fact reduce the amount of time involved. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of comments that we've addressed through some modifications to the checklist relatively late, you know, before presenting it to you that came out of one engineer's specific comments. So I think by and large it's been received well, but we have not officially implemented it yet, so this is just kind of a back-and-forth exchange where we send it out by email, and I've not heard back from all that many people, which perhaps no news is good news. It's, right. It's kind of hard to say, but the ones that have responded
they're
have
not
been
paying
positive.
Attention.
Yeah.
And my second question is going back to Jordan Lake rules and the NDPS. Whether or not you anticipate that any changes that are made in, you know, as the rules go into effect and as things transition locally around those rules, will this be flexible enough to work with that?
Yeah, to address that, I think the way we've set this up, we didn't spend a lot of time or a lot of your money developing BMP rules and regulations or a design manual, a 400-page design manual like some of the municipalities have for these BMPs. The state's done a real good job. They have a BMP manual, and they update it periodically based on new things they find, new technologies they find, new devices that they find that work better than the old devices. And we feel that's as good a reference point as you would need. So basically what we have done in the checklist is we have said you can use the BMP manual. We encourage you to use this BMP manual. However, if you've got some device that you have seen work well in other situations, or you can get us the technology and the material that the design came from, that we'll look at those devices and we'll look at those the same as we do the DWQ devices. But that's the way we feel that the best way to do it. So we feel like we have the flexibility with this so that if DWQ comes back tomorrow and says this device doesn't work at all anymore and throw it out and put in a brand new one, we don't have to change anything because we have that manual or that literature referenced in our.
And so with an adjustment in the timing, do you anticipate that that's something with the implementation of the Jordan Lake rules, that's something that will have to be reviewed at a later point, or you think that changing around the timing of the process is still going to be?
It's possible. It's conceivable that we may have to review and alter something about the checklist, but I think Henry is, if I'm hearing him correctly, the way this checklist is set up, it refers to this manual such that if that manual is updated, you know, our checklist simply refers to the latest version of it.
Right.
I guess as, you know, what you might call a worst-case scenario, if we do make these changes to the land use ordinance, we might have to come back and make subsequent changes to reflect whatever changes have been made at the state level. But that's true not of only the checklist. The ordinance would probably already need that change.
Right. Randy, if I'm hearing your question correctly, too, I think the potential change in the order of process would be impacted in any way by the Jordan Lake rules. Those rules care about the end result before we start building. I don't think the state cares about at what point in the review process the requirements are met, as long as before they start digging anything, we've got an approved plan that shows it'll meet the guidelines.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yes, it's set up to take it from the permit stage to the construction plan stage, but all of the information has to be in order before they could break ground.
Got it. Great.
All right. Any further questions on that?
Nope.
Dan?
Yeah, I'd like to move attachment A with the addition of the request for staff for the background information that I mentioned earlier.
Second.
All right. So moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously. Item D3, a follow-up report on races and special events, temporary street closings. Mr. Manager.
Yep. This is to help to facilitate some further discussion by the board about various races and other special events that require temporary street closings. And George Size, our public works director, has a presentation for you all. George.
Good evening, everyone.
Hey, George.
Hey, George.
Jorge.
Hola. At the March 23rd, 2010 public hearing for one of the races this past spring, the Carborough Classic, board members had expressed some concerns in general about some of the running events and other special events, in concerns about the number of the events, potential inconveniences, and were also interested in who were some of the benefited organizations. So the staff specifically was asked to provide a list of the events, including dates, the event organizer, the tax status of the organizations, and a listing of the organizations who receive support from that. So this is in your packet, and I just want to let you know what slides I have, and we certainly can go back to these. The other thing that's in your packet with the events, we put together a summary of the four races that were taking place in 09 and then in 2010. These others, the last three here, will be repeated again this year. But it shows the percentage of Carborough participants and then also a percentage of Carborough Chapel Hill participants. And, of course, we get entries from outlying areas as well as Hillsborough, Durham, and so forth. To supplement that, we went back to an earlier report in April 2008, which I'll mention in just a minute, and I summarized this the same way again. However, there was another race in this one here, the Carborough Classic. What's interesting is that a couple of years ago, the percentages of Carborough residents was actually a little higher. Overall, participation has gone up in the number of people participating in the each event, but the percentages of Carborough residents has dropped slightly. Now, this, again, is 2 years ago. I also have, to help facilitate if we want discussion about the race courses, I apologize for this one. I had to make some last-minute changes. And then we have the Cardinal Track Club events here as well, so you get a sense for what streets they're on. And just want to add that also in your packet is the report from April of 2008. And it was back then that, this report was put together in a response from concerns from board members about the number of special events in each year. But that report addressed all of our events, not just running events. The most recent concerns expressed back in March were about running events. And again, these are some of the same concerns the staff has raised with recent inquiries by the board in terms of closing streets in the downtown. And some other potential special events. And I think as a staff, again, we're concerned about budget impacts, limited resources, and I think all of us are trying to strike a balance here between the number and types of activities that you'd expect in an active and vibrant community, balancing that with anticipated disruptions, but not to be a nuisance to non-participants. So I know there's a lot of information trying to know over in my course of the years here, all the different things that have been expressed, and I've tried to provide a lot of information. I'm not sure really exactly what you want to talk about. Any and all of it.
Well, yeah. I'd like to start by thanking you for the wonderful creative planters at the parking lot on Greensboro and Carr Street. those are looking very, very Carrboro and really neat. So,
you're welcome. Thank you.
So that doesn't have anything to do with this, but I want to thank you for that.
Well, excuse me. I'm sorry to interrupt. I did want to point out that we have some folks here to assist with answering questions tonight. I'm sorry, Jackie, but Anita from Parks and Rec, Chief Hutchinson is here, and Captain Booker from Police, and Susie Hausman from the Kidney Care Race is here, and Dick Forbes from the Cardinal Track Club. So
I think you've given great information, and I appreciated it. It's very illuminating. My concern sometimes is that we're such a good place to have these events that I don't want like every other week for there to be an event. I think it would burn out our citizens, and it would certainly burn out our staff. But
and your knees, I would think.
And not mine. yours, maybe. I see you out there. Anyway, because we're so good at it, and we're such a good place to have it, I want to be careful that it doesn't become the default place. Oh, let's go do it in Carrboro. Carrboro is easy. Yeah, let's ask Carrboro their processes. So, but this information is good to have. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out also in the packet is information on how street permits are approved and
right.
so forth, and to address kind of what you're getting at. Maybe it's not so easy. Any new events usually start with a phone call to Public Works or Police or Parks and Rec, and then it's initially reviewed to see whether it's feasible, falls within and within the realm of that part of the ordinance and needing a permit. And then an application is submitted. The application is reviewed by a committee made up of police, fire, public works, parks and rec, if it involves something in one of the parks. And then all of that is done before it's brought forth to the
right.
board. So it's fairly carefully scrutinized to make sure that things are worked out. We don't want to present something that we don't think will work.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that the process, that people were pushovers. I just meant that Carrboro may be more warm and welcoming and have a better layout than some larger municipalities in the area. I certainly know that you...
It's flat.
Yeah, and it's flat.
Yeah, it's pretty flat. It's a good flat run.
He's first.
Dan
and
thanks. Thanks for this report, George. First thing I just wanted to mention is I was really pleased to see in the one table the list of the benefited organizations, because I think every one of these are organizations that we can be proud of the fact that these races are coming to Carrboro and supporting in the way that they do. I also want to say that I think these races are really good for Carrboro, that we have a culture of active citizenry, of physical activity, of health, and that these races contribute to that. And I personally know people who, just because of the awareness of people, their neighbors or their friends or coworkers who are running in their races, get the idea, well, hey, maybe I can do that, and who get off the couch and do the 5K and, you know, and go from there. And that's a wonderful thing and something to be supported and encouraged. I agree with Jackie that at some point there could be too much, but I think, you know, looking at five races over the course of a year, I think we're a long way from that. So my own perspective is that I would want the welcome mat to be out, that if there are races that are as well organized and responsible and bring the kind of benefits that these groups do, that I would be interested in seeing, possibly a couple more come to Carrboro if they exist. If not, this is really a nice group of events that we have here. So I think, you know, part of what I'm saying is to you two who are organizers of these events, thank you for doing such a good job with it, you know, not just for the people in Carrboro, but for the people around the region who participate. And I think it does add to our community in many, many ways, the health, and also bringing people into Carrboro who might not come otherwise.
Right.
Oh, I have a list, I'm sorry. Randy?
Yeah. God, it's hard to follow Dan. I have three of the same points, but yeah, I love that the runs and biking events are tied to values. And the specific groups are benefiting. I think that's really important. I really applaud Jackie on asking us to look at this and to look at the timing of it, because there are times that it seems to all come together, and it seems like every week something else is cooking, but I guess it's just Carrboro. You know, Carrboro is home to Fleet Feet, and on Wednesday and Thursday nights we see all the runners out, which I think is, as a runner myself, I think it's super wonderful. It is a very active living community, and I think people really enjoy seeing that. So I think having events like this that are spread out over the calendar year really are supportive of different groups getting out and participating. I think that's just part of the fabric that makes Carrboro as wonderful as it is. I think that, you know, as we see this table, and George, you did a great job of setting this up, because it's really evident, you know, where there, you know, there are possible openings and where it's just too tight, which I think is really good to know as people may be interested in presenting an event to the town. So I think that's been great. I think the running is wonderful. I want to thank Susie and Dick for all the work that they've done over the years, and all the runners and the bike events in Carrboro, because I really think that it's a great opportunity. And I also think that Carrboro businesses benefit from it. So,
Lydia?
Yeah, I ditto Dan, ditto Randy. Her last point was, I was going to make that one also, that not only do these folks come here, run, enjoy our town, they stick around, go to Weaver Street, go to Farmers Market, you know, see what we have, and it's really just fabulous. I appreciate the compilation of all this info, George. Two points I want to make. One is, and this is one I've brought up before, and that is this distinction between groups that sponsor races or runs that are nonprofit groups versus profit groups. And as I reflect on this a little, maybe that's not the crux of what I'm trying to get at with this. Maybe it's more so that I don't want a profit group to come in and make a lot of money off of a race that we're putting out a whole lot of, you know, effort and staff time, et cetera, to provide the race. So that's my question is whether, because we only have one of these groups that's listed as a profit group. All of the others are nonprofits. Now, even the profit group, you know, had listed some organizations to which it was going to donate the proceeds. And perhaps it was all of the proceeds. I mean, I don't know. And if it was, then fine. You know, I just think that's something worth us reflecting on. And I think I brought this up last time we discussed this, that as with most of these groups, as with the Cardinal Track Club, UNC Kennedy Center, I'd like to see the money, you know, stay in Orange County, go to the nonprofits in Orange County, because we're worried about them. We fund them. We look out for them. We have Habitat for Humanity. Right, we have Habitat for Humanity in Orange County. So if the board would like to take that up in some manner, I'd like to see if anyone is interested in talking about that. And the other question, just quick question I had.
Before you go on,
okay.
What manner would you suggest we take?
Well, I don't know if, I guess initially I could ask staff.
Yeah, I would be interested in referring those questions to the town attorney about whether whether you even can draw a distinction between a profit and nonprofit organization.
Well, I know we can or do certainly sometimes as to what we charge them to certain rentals or events or so on. So that's kind of one question. And then secondly, yeah, I guess just for the attorney, whether we can direct them to try to donate proceeds.
Or you're asking like for Habitat for Humanity that's in Durham, if that could be redirected to the Orange County branch. Is that what you mean?
Or just suggest anyone holding an event here where they're using
We can certainly suggest it. I guess the question
at least to the tune
do
of
anything
what,
more than that.
Right. At but, least to the tune of what it cost us.
Any reason you could not? I mean, these are all events where you're closing streets, not for political events, but for call them social events, athletic events, whatever. I don't think you raise any First Amendment kinds of issues. And I think if you want to say, you know, if you want to adopt a policy that says we're going to limit the events to those that are either nonprofit or that share the proceeds with Orange County groups, that, for example, the Carver Funds, I don't know of any reason why you can't do that. I think you have quite a bit of control over the streets and street closing situation.
I know in some cases the nonprofits partner with other nonprofits who then provide volunteer work at the races. You know, they staff the races, give out water, you know, register, hand out T-shirts, whatever. And I would just, you know, and we have plenty of groups I know here in Carrboro or Orange County that could garner volunteers to work in that effort, I would think, having worked in many road races over the years.
Most of them are. To this, I mean, most of these
right.
are. So,
right.
If I could add a piece of information here that even though these are listed as profit, nonprofit, I think another category here is that the between town-supported and what I would call these also as private, these folks pay for the additional services above and beyond in terms of additional police, public works, and so forth, where on town-sponsored events where the town is part of it, that is not charged back to the group because the town is part of that.
They're paid to cover direct cost and some portion of indirect cost, or is it all direct cost?
Well, the application fee, $60, helps to cover some of the preliminary aspects of it. The review, of course, when you have three or four people in the room for a couple hours, I'm not sure that $60 is mm-hmm. is covering that. But then they do pay the public. If there's a public hearing needed, that cost is paid. And then usually we're not charging for the preliminary, but we do charge for then people who are brought in on the weekends, police officers or public works folks for that time.
Right. That's fair.
Mm-hmm. That gets passed on.
Yes, ma'am.
I had actually a question about the other special events, because I ditto and agree with everything that's been said previously about the racing part. To anyone on staff who could answer it, I was looking to see which one of all these events consumes the most time. For police, parks and rec, public works. And interestingly enough, for the police, it's Chapel Hill Halloween.
That's right.
So I'm sure you've told me this before when I've asked it before. Do we get any reimbursement for that?
No.
Okay.
Unless we have, and I don't think the last couple of years, Carolyn and Joel, that we've had officers actually working in Chapel Hill.
Oh, okay.
They get paid. But for what we have to do to protect our borders, if you will,
right.
We've asked, but we've never received any compensation that I'm aware of.
I just want to say, because I didn't watch the Chapel Hill thing on what they're going to do about the library and the fiscal situation, but I do want the board members to remind Chapel Hill that we don't live in a vacuum. So if you're going to charge me for the library,
yeah.
Then you have some influence on the quality of our life once a year to a tremendous amount, which we don't even have. I don't believe they have to watch their borders when we have the music festival. So I just throw that out there as a thought when there's a response about the cost of things in the county.
All right. Duly noted.
The second question, actually, I had did have to do with some of these other events that are listed under activities covered, and I just wondered about the significance or why they're included in this. I guess just to say outside groups that use or request the use of our police staff, I guess that's it, like Sphinx Store, and Park and Ride Lot, Rice's Glass, Surplus SIDS. Is this just to show different ways that our police provide security at different
businesses? It was an attempt to show the resources that we devote, even though, again, that in some cases these folks are paying for these services, we have limited staff capacity sometimes especially if events are either overlapping on the same weekend or succeeding weekends and so forth. You know, sometimes overtime, I guess I've described, and it can be like candy. Too much of it isn't, you know, just you have enough of it, and you have limited folks that can work, and they want to spend time at home as well. So I think that's one of the things that was trying to be brought out in the report back in 2008, that we have a pretty good balance with what we have, but when we start adding events, and I'm sure there's a lot of good events, and we are a warm and friendly place, the staff is concerned not only from a budget standpoint, but from a staff capacity mm-hmm. standpoint to be able to keep maintaining.
So I guess, so my question is, these are private sponsored type events or businesses that require or ask for the use of our police department for security?
That's correct, yes.
And but presumably, if our police department were not able to provide security, they would contract with some other private security group.
I'll have to ask Chief to Captain Booker to respond.
I guess that's difficult to answer when they call and want police services. We try to provide it for them because I don't think anybody in Carlborough can do it the way that we do it in Carlborough. Exactly. I think sometimes we're a victim of our own successes. So, you know, when they do it in Surplus Cities, he's always calling us. It's Cat's Cradle. They call the officer. So we try to take care of business in Carlborough as best we can. Could they hire private security? They certainly could, but our experience with that is it is not the best service.
Okay. And in most of these cases, they pay for the service?
The privately sponsored events, if it's a Cat's Cradle event, some of the races, they pay for the officers to do that. And there are town-sponsored events where we put officers there who have to get their time back by some other means, either by payment through the town or by comp time, which then runs us short on duty requirements and things like that.
Okay. Thanks.
So for 4 on the 4th, somebody else pays, and for the 4th of July, we pay.
Lydia, I'm wondering what you think of this idea, which would be if we could find out from the Kidney Center and the track club what proportion of the entry fee actually goes to support the benefited organizations, and then we could perhaps come up with a standard for a profit-making enterprise that was based on that, and say that, you know, this percent needs to benefit Orange County nonprofits.
Well, I think that sounds great. I mean, they're kind of the standard we have to go by. So I guess I'd like to suggest that that we find out that information.
And maybe that would discourage some of the ones Jackie doesn't want to come here to go somewhere else.
It's not, I just don't want to have them every week or mm-hmm. even every other week. I want them to be spaced out and to not take over. And I want the people that are participating in them to be mindful that they are in somebody's community and to, because sometimes some of them could use some better manners when it comes to how they interact. But I'm not against having for-profit groups do this, and I don't want to limit them too greatly, because that's a neat little business, you know, putting these things together. I do know that most of the for-profit groups also will partner with a nonprofit, and in that case, I'd like to encourage them to partner with Orange County nonprofits. But
you don't think we should have a standard at all, or?
I think that as far as the percentage, I wouldn't want to be making that decision. Uh-huh. But I would want them to be partnering with a local organization, or maybe let me step back a little bit. Maybe a certain percentage, but I wouldn't want it to be
prohibitively high.
Well, and we don't want to micromanage yeah. the race. I mean, it
right.
might be,
mm-hmm.
you know, they get a certain type of shirt or a certain type of, they give out certain giveaways,
yeah.
you know. But my experience with these is that in most cases, you know, there's some benefit that accrues to the nonprofit, and whatever
right.
that would be, would
yeah.
be.
Why don't we just have a requirement that the events be benefiting Orange County-based nonprofit organizations right. and leave it at that?
Okay.
I'm fine with that motion.
Yeah, that's simple.
Is the motion really, I guess, to ask the attorney or the staff or whoever to draft something specific for that, or is that adequate?
Right, I think that
is that motion good. Adequate on its own? Do you follow my question?
I think I understand the question. I think there should certainly be something in writing that the staff can say when they get an application, our policy is X.
Okay, the motion is for some of y'all to bring back a proposed policy along those lines.
And could that motion be part of our receiving the report?
Yes, and also to receive the report.
So that's attached so A moved. With
second.
All right, it's moved by Dan and seconded by Lydia. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the matter passes unanimously.
Thank you.
I have a follow-up tangent, if I may. Chief, could you come up for a minute? Since we're talking about events, I thought I'd get a concern off my chest. When I go to the farmer's market, as I'm sure lots of people do, I take note of the cars that are basically idling in the lot out here in hopes of a parking space opening. And there's often quite a few backed up, and it goes on much of the morning. And I guess I'm wondering, A, has there been any attempt to address that from a logistical standpoint? And B, do you feel like it would be appropriate for your department to meet with the farmers market folks and look at the traffic patterns on BIM and Laurel and through the parking lots, and if there's a better way of managing that so traffic is flowing, and if there's not a parking space, vehicles aren't waiting for one, that they're directed to where there is a parking space.
A more distant spot where there's a parking space.
Well, yeah, now we do have officers that work farmers market.
Right.
And this is the first time I've heard the concern about the idling, and it makes sense to me. So, yes, that's something that we can look at. I do know from the times I've been there and I've watched the officer in action, he or she is sort of directing the drivers to the spots that open up.
Right, but my point is he's not directing them through if
right.
there's not an open space.
Right. And yeah, I think we can look at that, and maybe we can also suggest to the farmers market manager that they do a little bit of advertising in-house for all of the available parking in the area.
Okay. And you can let us know what you
sure.
resolve on that. Steve, do you want a motion on that point?
Wait. I want to discuss this for a minute.
Okay.
I don't want people to be hurried because sometimes you see somebody coming. I can speak for myself. Sometimes I see somebody coming to a space and I'm the closest person there. And I must tell you, I might be slightly irritated if I had to move when I was waiting. I mean, you could tell people, cut your car off until the people come out there or if they're not blocking it. I think it has to be done in common sense. I think if you go early in the morning at 7 o'clock, you pretty much find a parking space. If you're out there with all the what I call the senior citizens who get out there early at 7 to get the best sort of selection, I think it's got to be a balancing test. You know, I mean, if it's a hazard for traffic, then yeah, they should move on. But if it's, we don't want to discourage people from, some people can't carry all the stuff they get there and walk to the farmer's market. Sometimes you need to have your car for either physical reasons or because you buy enough stuff where you're going to can.
Car.
Well, you're going to can them.
Right.
I just, for my birthday, got a new pressure cooker, so look for jelly in the fall. But I think it's sort of like a common sense thing. I think it's a common sense thing, and I don't want to discourage people coming to our farmer's market.
I don't want it to be like when you're at the airport and they keep yelling at
you. Yeah, exactly.
I want them out there with mirrors to look under.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting a solution. I was suggesting something.
A meeting is actually what I heard him suggest.
Because idling is a bad thing for people and other breathing creatures.
Well, having both of those contexts to the motion, it was moved by Dan that we asked the police department to look into this.
And I'll second it, just as long as I'm not hurrying.
Joel seconded it with the right context. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, matter passing unanimously. So before you leave the podium, Chief, I just wanted to recognize, at this point I've not even learned the name of the officer, but one of your officers, I understand, has been pursuing a cold case.
Yes.
And we're proud to say, it was announced earlier today, that the Carrboro Police Department and the North Carolina SBI made an arrest in a 26-year-old murder case coming out of Carrboro, owing to the leadership of the Carrboro Police Department in analyzing DNA evidence that was collected long ago, but for which technology did not then exist to do the analysis.
Right.
And I just want to say that makes me very proud to live in Carlboro.
Yeah, good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right.
Okay. That leaves us on item D4, a discussion of the town clerk recruitment and selection process. I don't know whether the board really needs a presentation from the staff on what's been recommended thus far. Don't really have one, so you better not need one.
Looks fine.
I have just two thoughts I wanted to share, if I might, on this.
depends
on whether I have to go to the podium.
Take too long.
Guess you need to put the timer.
Yeah, exactly. On attachment B3, which I think is that the sort of proposed advertisement or something like that?
It's not the proposed one.
It's been running.
It's a gen running ad.
It's after June 1st.
Okay, I thought this referred.
But you need to read your email more time.
No, I know, but.
Yeah.
You're welcome to read it.
I do.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. That's what I wanted to know. I mean, I think, the one thing I wanted to just point out is I think that one thing that Sarah has done admirably is adapt to the changing technology of communication.
Yes.
Based upon the Internet. And I believe that will continue to become a more and more important feature of the job of town clerk is relating to the public via the Internet. And so I just wanted to put it out there that I think in some way, we ought to be looking for a candidate who has some demonstrated skills and capacity in that way.
But we don't want them twittering during their interview.
Right. Right.
No, but on the other hand, the town of Chapel Hill makes public announcements via Facebook right
yes.
now. If you're friends with their public information officer on Facebook, I think there's some innovative possibilities out there in terms of how we could be communicating
for those people who don't stay on Facebook.
Well,
there might be another technology that comes.
And there are some people that are working on the open source beyond Facebook site. But anyway, I guess the point is to be adaptable to whatever those new technologies are as they emerge. And I just wanted to emphasize that at some stage in this process. So is there.
I'll move to
second.
Accept attachment A.
All right. Resolution.
Go ahead. No, I just was going to say thank you for sending out that list. Sharman sent the list today.
Okay, great. So it's attachment A has been moved.
Properly seconded.
And seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, matter passed unanimously.
I have one little question to ask.
I have a little question, too.
Good. I'm going first.
Go ahead.
All right. The Carrboro Citizen had the ad yet again for the seat on the planning board for the ETJ to close the 10th of June, and I know that we passed
a resolution.
Yes, we did, and I want to know why that ad was in there. And I was wondering if I wanted to ask staff to look into that.
Yeah,
No, I did not send that to them.
No, I think Orange County did, and that's why I would like staff to look into that. Okay. It was in this week's Citizen.
Did it say where to send the applications?
Hillsborough.
Then it was there.
Then it wouldn't have been there.
And you see that
your
means...
Your resolution was sent to the county.
I know. So,
okay.
You know.
Well, perhaps we could have a follow-up inquiry from the staff level about this matter.
Does that require a motion?
I don't think it probably does.
Okay, thank you.
Then.
Marty, are you able to tell us something about what's proposed for Wendy's?
Yes.
Now, all right. Get to the important stuff.
Like a five-story Wendy's?
Hey, wait a minute. The planning board is...
Yeah, to the extent you can, because I think Hudson citizens would be interested in...
That's why I was going to turn in the mic. Well, what went to the Appearance Commission, there were two versions. One, I think it's fair to say, represents kind of their traditional new building model that would have covered up a fair amount of the brick with stucco along the Main Street side. Let me make sure I have this straight. Yes, the Main Street side. And then the second option had removed a large portion of the stucco and left the brick in place, and the Appearance Commission predictably preferred that model. The front facing Greensboro Street looks very similar in option A and option B, and I think it's fair to say, I don't necessarily want to speak for the applicant, but I think it's fair to say that they feel strongly about that front kind of image that they're projecting out. You know, corporations, I'm sure we all recognize, have kind of image makeovers where they redesign things periodically, and I think this is just a time when Wendy's is doing that, and I think the very short version is they're trying to make it look more like the brand new restaurant they build nowadays.
What does that look like?
Well, again, the first version had a lot of stucco and wouldn't necessarily have much brick, but the Main Street side now maintains much of the brick. The entranceway along Main Street, I'm trying to make sure I have my street straight here. The entranceway along Main Street has some accents, some new accents that involve some stonework, kind of stone columns, and that's about the main change. Also the signage, they want to take down the wood signs because they look weathered. Those were wooden signs that to some degree were supposed to look weathered, but they feel like they're past their prime and they want to replace the signage and
signs are worn out.
Replace some of the lighting. the proposed lighting is kind of a gooseneck historical looking light, so it's not that much different than kind of mm-hmm. the feel of that area already. But let me flip over to the Greensboro side, the front facade. You know how it has kind of that front area is shorter than the rest of the building? Mm-hmm. It raises that up so that it's level all the way across the building now, and the top of it has kind of a curved feature on the top, and that's kind of their new image, is this curved feature is an identifying architectural
the
theme.
Feature.
Kind of looks like a bun.
So is it made out of... Is that made out of brick?
There's some stucco proposed for the front. But again, it's kind of...
The Greensboro Street side?
On the Greensboro side. And and also, again, the stone accents on either side of the facade, there would be stone accents running up. And
Where in the development review process is this?
Yeah.
We've received their official application, and it has gone to the Appearance Commission, and we're...
And the application is treated as a
Minor modification. Yes.
So will we not see it?
That's correct.
Board of Adjustment.
Board of Adjustment.
There you go.
Is it going next week to Board of Adjustment?
No, there was a possibility it would go in June, but it's looking like July because we still have to review some of the lighting features for ordinance compliance. So they're trying to get it done just because I don't think it's fair to characterize them as trying to rush us. They just have a timeline where they're trying to, you know, get these things done by the end of this calendar year. But I think we're going to take it in July instead of June.
Mr. Attorney, would it be inappropriate in any way for the staff to circulate a copy of the proposed drawings to the Board of Aldermen, or just an informational
No, I mean, they're all public documents. Anybody can go see them.
Okay, well, so why don't we just leave it at that? If the staff would forward copies of the
email sufficient, I have color.
I'd like it
in my packet on Friday.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Send it to us in paper on Friday. That'd be great.
Okay. I assume we're not talking about communicating directly with the Board of Adjustment members, but for your own information.
It's not appropriate for members of this board to call members of the Board of Adjustment to talk to them about it. That's
just
for,
to be clear.
They're going to make their own independent decisions that would be based upon the public hearing.
We can go to the public hearing.
I defer to the attorney, but I think anybody has a right to be in the public hearing.
Just to clarify, as a minor modification, I do not know yet whether there will be a public hearing.
Well, that's true. It may not be a public hearing.
Well, but nevertheless,
there will be a public meeting.
And I guess
and
it will
the
be
public board. Speak at that public meeting?
I'm sure they'd be welcome to speak, yes.
But normally, the Board of Adjustment allows the public to speak.
Yeah, it'd be up to the Board of Adjustment to decide whether to recognize members of the public. I would think so.
I think, in summary, the biggest changes you would see are along Greensboro Street. Some changes are proposed along Main Street, but the Greensboro Street side looks largely like if you happen to see a new Wendy's around, you'll recognize what I'm going to send you by email.
It'll be helpful as an informational matter to take a look at it.
It disappears.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
All right.
Move we adjourn.
And second to adjourn, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter of fact, thanks.